you know, it's been kind of picking back up, but there's concerns, real concerns about whether or not there are enough people to actually build all the stuff that IIJA is supposed to be paying for.
I am Reese Tisdale, and this is Future Water, which we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. So I got to say it, Happy New Year. This is the first episode of 2023, but it's also episode 63 of the Future of Water. You know what that means? There are 62 other ones that you should be listening to. There's some really good insights out there. And quite honestly, you might as well stick around for this because I think it's going to be a good one. Today, I'm going to be joined by my colleagues, Eric Bendler and Lauren Balsamo from Bluefield Research, to talk about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA, as some call it, and how the legislated funds are unfolding from California to Maine. We'll be talking about things like total announced funding, how it's associated with the legislation, or sort of what categories it falls into, but also where it is all happening. I know we've put together a big data set with the help of our one and only federal government. Just to put it in perspective, there have been about $186 billion of funds announced and or allocated, of which I think about $10.5 billion has been announced for water-designated projects. And hey, we're here to talk about water. With that being said, I also wanted to bring up another part of the IIJA, and that is the Build America, Buy America domestic sourcing requirements that are also enacted as part of the legislation. That is something that has come up a lot with clients, as well as other industry professionals, trying to get a feel for what's happening in not only with the supply chain, but what are the requirements and how are they going to change over time? I know we've talked to our colleague, Greg Goodwin, about that, I think in the past on this podcast, but we're going to give some updates on how things have changed. But before we do that, I also wanted to just raise one thing for everybody at Bluefield Research. We have a webcast coming up on February 3rd, I believe. But just to be sure, you might as well go to www.bluefieldresearch.com and check out our website. We've got webcasts that we do put out more or less on a quarterly basis about key trends and topics that are happening in the water industry. This one, it's going to be on capital and operating expenditure forecasts across the U.S. over the next decade. There's a lot of detail in there. I'm not going to lie. We look across dozens and dozens of categories from, you know, network and collection to treatment facilities and plants, not only in the U.S., but also Canada. So take advantage of the opportunity, get some insights into what we're thinking, how we do it, what our methodology is. And also while you're at our website, learning more about the upcoming webcast, you can also register for Waterline. That's our weekly newsletter. Comes out every Wednesday from top to bottom. It gives some of the things that our analysts think are really interesting news and other topics that are happening not only in North America, but also around the world, what it means for the water industry. But also you get deals and updates on what we're putting out there, whether it be research, perspectives, data sets, all of the above. You do learn a little bit as you go, but also, you know, there's some freebies out there. You don't have to pay for all of it, but that's a good opportunity when you're on our website. So don't be a stranger. Give it a look. So now that we've gotten through that, why don't we bring in the most important people of the conversation, Eric Bendler and Lauren Balsamo, to talk about what is happening with IIJA and how it's impacting the spending across the U.S. municipal water sector. All right. So I'm joined here by Eric Bendler and Lauren Balsamo. Happy New Year's, guys. Happy New Year, should I say, not years. Eric, how's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Good to be kind of back in action and trying to figure out what we're going to be working on this year. Planning out the research calendar, and we got a lot of really exciting stuff coming up. And, you know, just looking forward to the new year.
I know, sort of like up to this point, end of December, up to now, you're sort of like living in two worlds. It's like, I need to finish what's in 2022, and now we're in what are we going to do in 2023? Now we just have to change gears. So I'm with you on that. Lauren, how about you? How are things? What's, given that you're from upstate New York, is everybody out of their igloos and what used to be homes? All good with you?
Yeah, fortunately, my family's from the more east side of the state, so we were spared the storm. But watching the news and seeing everybody buried was definitely a sight to see around Christmas time. And I know my brother was a little worried to go back to Buffalo because he goes to law school there. So he was watching to see what was unfolding. But yep, we're all good.
Are New Yorkers judgy about east and west, other than like New York City versus the rest of the state?
Yeah, a little bit. It's like there's Western New York, Upstate New York, Downstate New York. If you say you're from Upstate, they're like, well, are you from?
Don't say anything bad.
Yeah.
Don't say anything bad about it.
We have our zones in the state, if you can say.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. I've never really thought about it. I just know people not from New York City don't like people from New York City, should I say. Maybe that's harsh. All right. Well, look, guys, the IIJA, it's a big topic of 2023. I think it was one of the key trends that we've highlighted going into this year, trying to figure out, you know, where the dollars, it's a fair amount of dollars that are being injected into the water and wastewater sectors on the municipal side. Clients have been asking about it, but we've also given your research or through your research tracking how that funding is being rolled out. And if anything, like I said, it's injection into the market, but also sort of giving some ballast to a water sector that is facing, I don't know if headwinds is the right word because things seem to be moving along, but at least some uncertainty when it comes to supply chain and recession and all of that. That those questions are still out there, but IIJA seems to be helping out. So why don't we sort of frame this a little bit, Eric, and maybe start with you and start at a high level. What's the impetus behind our research? What are we thinking? Sort of, why don't you sort of frame the house for us?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to kind of piggyback off what you said, Reese, you know, IIJA, people have kind of referred to this as a once in a lifetime funding opportunity for, you know, for the water sector, for infrastructure more broadly. As you said, our clients are very interested in understanding what's going on here. And just to set some kind of basic information, I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of this, but it's, you know, the legislation overall is $550 billion over a five-year period. $55 billion, so about 10% of that, is explicitly earmarked for water, wastewater, and stormwater infrastructure. But we also went through the full legislation last year and found about another $75 billion or so in funding that, you know, could be applicable to water. It's not necessarily listed as water, but issues related to climate resilience or environmental remediation or cybersecurity, these are all things that, you know, water utilities or communities could benefit from as well. You know, but again, there's obviously the very positive side of this, and people in the industry were feeling pretty optimistic when this kind of made it through into law. But there are some challenges, right? There are some headwinds that we've been kind of paying attention to over the past year or so from an implementation perspective. You know, obviously the industry, the water sector, is facing a major labor shortage. It's especially acute on the construction side. You know, we kind of track the data on a quarterly basis, and water construction employment in the U.S. is still about 8 to 10% below where it was prior to the Great Recession. You know, it's been kind of picking back up, but there's concerns, real concerns, about whether or not there are enough people to actually build all the stuff that IIJA is supposed to be paying for. And then you also have, you know, utilities themselves, government agencies. There's just, you know, everybody's kind of short-staffed. There are these limitations around managing projects, managing funding applications, reviewing it, and the project owner side of things as well. So there's concerns there. As you mentioned a couple of seconds ago, you know, the supply chain side of things, pricing is still through the roof for a lot of really important components in the industry. Product availability is probably even a bigger concern. I mean, you know, for some types of products, we've heard about lead times well over a year just to get, you know, the material, the equipment that you need to build your projects or to kind of execute your projects. And so it's having a really significant impact on actually getting this stuff built, you know, in the timeframe that is allotted under the IIJA. And then, as we're going to be getting into, on top of all of that, the IIJA, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, also included some pretty stringent new domestic sourcing requirements in the way of the Build America, Buy America Act, or BABA. And the whole industry, whether it be utilities, consultants, manufacturers, everybody's been really trying to scramble to understand what those requirements actually mean and kind of how to meet them for, you know, for basically the most, if not all, of last year. So all of that brings me to the question of, why are we looking at this right now? We're just about to put out a kind of a new report, a new status update on IIJA. And really the kind of impetus on our end was we got two really important new pieces of information in November. So just, you know, just about a month and a half ago. The first was that the EPA Office of Water released some pretty extensive new guidance documentation on just how BABA, the domestic sourcing piece of this, is going to be handled within the water industry. So that was really interesting to see their kind of line of thinking. And we can dig into a little bit of that in a couple minutes. The second piece was that the White House released a kind of a status report on just, you know, how things are going with the IIJA overall, you know, about a year in. It was released, as I said, in November, which was about a year after the bill was signed. And so what we see there is basically of that $550 billion total for the five-year period, the White House is telling us how much of that has already been announced or kind of committed to specific states, to specific projects. It gives us a good idea of really just whether or not the funding is on track based on kind of the timelines that were set out when the legislation was actually signed into law, and whether some of those roadblocks that I just mentioned are impacting the flow of funds or not.
So, I mean, I think that raises a good point. I mean, some of the, while it's great for the water wastewater sector, I think even when you started, you're talking about this is a once in a lifetime investment or opportunity. I can't remember exactly how you framed it, but my point is, I think we're going to need a lot more of these, quite honestly, going forward, given the state of the world, and that's infrastructure, climate, and everything else. But, one of the frustrations, I think, when you sort of look at the bar chart, the pie chart, however it's being illustrated, is the water sector, broadly speaking, is not the only one receiving funding. How does it stack up to the others?
Yeah, so as far as what we've seen, what this kind of new White House data set on announced or committed funding to date, they frame it as announced funding, so we'll use that terminology, announced funding to date, about $186 billion is included in that data set, which is about a third of the $550 billion total, which is set for that kind of five-year period, right, 22 to 26. The funding per this White House data set is committed to just about 7,000 projects in about 4,000 communities. They've got projects in every state, all 50 states, D.C., all of the territories. So they're kind of making an effort to show that this money is starting to make its way out into kind of every part, every corner of the country. As far as distribution by sector, you're absolutely right. I mean, transportation accounts for about 80% of the total announced funding so far, which is a really big share. I mean, the bulk of that is kind of roads and bridges. You have a little piece for public transportation, for airports, for ports, and things like that. Climate and energy are also really big priorities. About 7% of the total announced funding so far goes to kind of resilience, which is obviously a broad category, but climate resilience, and then 5% also for clean energy and power. There's a piece for, EVs and electric school buses and things like that. To bring back to your question, water accounts for about 6% of the announced funding so far. So we've seen, if you can actually kind of filter the White House data set by subcategory, and if you filter for water, you get about $10.5 billion in announced funding so far. Again, that's, as we mentioned, in the context of $55 billion in total that was explicitly earmarked for the bill when it was signed about a year ago.
All right. So that's super helpful. Some of this we've sort of known that these were part of this were the plan. So Lauren, let's bring you into the conversation because you've been working a lot on this data set itself and scrubbing it and trying to figure out where all the funds are going. So simple question, how are these funds being distributed in water? What have we seen so far?
Yeah, so the majority of the funds being distributed to the water sector are being channeled through the existing State Revolving Fund or SRF program, and this accounts for about 43% of the funding. So this includes funds that are going through the general drinking water SRF and clean water SRF channels, as well as specific carve-outs to address lead service line replacement, as well as PFAS and other emerging contaminants. And just to take a quick step back for those who may be unfamiliar, the SRF programs are low interest loan and grant programs that are administered by individual states, but are funded primarily by the federal government with partial state matching requirements. And of the announced water related funds to date, 70% are set to go through the EPA's SRF program.
To tie into what Eric was saying, where do we stand as far as how much has been allocated? Are we on track?
Yeah, so the EPA is pretty much in line where they had said they would be for fiscal year 2022 funding set to be distributed through the SRF program. And so they're at about 95% of where they said they would be. So from a step back funding standpoint, they're doing pretty good. And this is something that we hope that as the years go on, they will continue to stay in line and the funding will keep being rolled out.
Nice. Yeah, that's super helpful because I know that's a question. I guess, if anything, not to be cynical or a skeptic, it's like, oh, they've announced all of this. Is it rolling out? But at least as far as announcements go, we're on track. So that's positive. How else are the funds being distributed?
digging a little deeper, regular annual funding through the Clean Water SRF and the Drinking Water SRF programs account for a combined $3.7 billion, or about 35% of the announced IIJA water funds to date. The funds set to go towards addressing lead service line replacement account for around $2.9 billion, or 28% of total announced water-related project funding, while funds to address PFAS and other emerging contaminants come in at approximately $772 million, or 7% of the total announced water funds across both the Drinking Water SRF and the Clean Water SRF programs. And in this round of announced funding, we also saw a pretty substantial amount going towards Indian water rights settlements at approximately 16% of the announced funding to date, which will go towards investing in drinking water and irrigation infrastructure for tribal communities in the states of Montana, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. And just one last point to round it off, we also see the prioritization of water efficiency and conservation in the West, with about 3% of the announced funds to date being channeled through Water Smart grants, of which 76% is going directly to addressing these issues in California.
Yeah, I mean, those two last points I think are really interesting. One is the Indian water rights settlements, and that's a focus, you know, that we've been working with clients recently, is looking at these reservations and how our water, wastewater utilities not only being managed, and but also everything from hardware, equipment opportunities, funding availability, but also O&M services as well. So the only reason I bring that up, because it's an interesting channel to market in what is, you know, a fragmented market. And so slicing and dicing and figuring out where the opportunities are is critical or interesting. But the other thing about, you know, Water Smart grants in California, what's happening out West, we've been getting a lot of questions about the Western U.S. and, you know, Colorado River water levels going down. You know, there's still no decision, as far as I know, on it across the seven states, upper and lower basins. But also, what's going to happen? What are a big question that has come to us? Are like, what are the trigger points? You know, you've got, all right, well, we don't hit the levels, but then what happens after that? But this is addressing, or at least opening up some of the funding, providing some funding to maybe mitigate some of the challenges. So, Eric, I don't know if you have anything to add to what Lauren was discussing.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to touch on the other points that Lauren made, which were the lead service line and the PFAS pieces. I mean, I think when you look at some of those numbers, again, she said, you know, almost $3 billion announced so far for lead service line replacement, about, you know, close to $800 million for PFAS. What's really interesting is we have another report actually underway that should be out hopefully in the next day or two on the state revolving fund program. You know, we do kind of an annual analysis. We go through each state's intended use plans, and we look at, you know, what types of projects are being requested, and you know, the kind of level of requested funding versus awarded funding, and how those kind of percentages play out across the country. And one of the things that's really interesting is we've, you know, just with the IIJA in mind, we've been kind of digging into more specific types of project categories, and really the data set that, you know, the report we're about to release, the most recent kind of round of data we collected, is it's almost kind of a pre-IIJA baseline, because while we did collect the data this year, again, it's really kind of the intended use plans from previous years of funding before all of this, you know, really explicit earmarked lead service line and PFAS funds are actually hitting the states, actually making it to the state SRF programs. And so it's kind of like, this is a snapshot of what SRF looks like prior to all of this IIJA funding, and where are we going to see it go from here? And one of the things that really stood out was that, you know, only about 1.5% of the total requested SRF funding that we saw last year was for lead service lines. Less than 0.5%, about 0.3%, was for PFAS. And so really, really, you know, small dollar values compared to these massive amounts of funding that are basically in the pipe that have been announced, that are being committed now to the states. And so that's really an area where we're going to see a lot of very significant growth, a lot of opportunity, a lot of dynamism, as this money just, it's, you know, so much greater than anything that the SRF programs have allocated to these areas in the past.
Yeah. And I think part of that, I suspect, is, you know, one, just inventorying the problem, whether it be for PFAS or for lead service lines, right? That's step one. We know we have clients who are actually working on that. Both cases. Then the other part is, at least on the PFAS or emerging contaminants, is the regulatory side. You know, there's a select number of states who actually have policies in place as Lauren, I think we've even talked about on this podcast, is sort of looking at the MCLs coming forward and how that's going to roll out from the EPA and federal government. But, you know, one of the things, Lauren, that I don't know if you admit, well, at least I know I looked at the draft. So truth be told, I have a little bit of a heads up on what's coming. But the question I have is for everybody is, which states have announced the most funding? I was a little surprised. You know, usually it's California, it's New York, it's Texas, it's Florida. You know, they sort of dominate the landscape for obvious reasons. But as far as number one states, that's not the case, if I read it correctly.
Yeah, so kind of coming out of left field here, we see that Montana actually tops the states for announced funding received to date, with around $1.3 billion going to them. And this is being driven primarily by the $1.2 billion it's receiving for those Indian water rights settlements that we were discussing previously. And the states of Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico are also receiving the remainder of this announced funding for Indian water rights settlements, with around $570 million being distributed across the three states, which also puts these states in the top 10 states for total funding that's been announced to date. And these states are also not ones that you would expect to be in the top 10. Then, as you getting back kind of onto the normal trends, California's received the second largest sum of funding at $1.2 billion, with a mix of drinking water SRF and clean water SRF allocations, as well as $278 million in the Water Smart grants that I mentioned previously, which is the largest sum of Water Smart grant funding received out of all the states. And then we have Texas sitting third in announced funding, as Texas has received the second largest sum of funds for addressing lead surface drying replacement through the drinking water SRF program at around $220 million, sitting just behind California's $250 million. And then the states of New York, Illinois, and Florida, and Ohio round out the top 10 states for funding allocations based on their drinking water SRF and clean water SRF allocations. And everything else is pretty much in line with what we would expect based on the state population size and number of water systems.
So that's really helpful, Lauren. So one question I have, and maybe I'll, because my next question just came out of that, but I have a question for you, Eric, as well. But I'll start with question one, and that is, these dollars have been allocated across these states. Do we have an idea whether they've been pointed at specific companies or technologies or solutions? I mean, I suspect not, but maybe you have some insights into that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we try to take care in the report and on this podcast and everything to try to be kind of mirror the language that the White House is using, which is basically announced funding. And that, I think it can mean, you know, a lot of different things. It's not a very precise terminology as far as I'm aware. And if you look at the data set, you'll see, you know, like for some of the SRF line items, they do have dollar amounts associated, you know, aggregate dollar amounts associated with individual states. But in other parts of the data, there'll be individual projects in specific cities or specific counties that have been identified for, you know, the Aging Infrastructure Fund, for example. I think maybe even the Indian Water Rights Settlement money that we were talking about has specific kind of projects called out within the data set. So again, if you think about how the SRF program operates, it's a pretty lengthy program where, you know, states get money, the state agencies get money from the federal government, and then individual communities submit applications, and then they kind of do go through this project selection process. So I think announced funding from the SRF perspective may be a little bit further up in the pipeline, whereas in some of these other cases, you know, a specific project has already been identified and maybe there's already, you know, bid opportunities out there. I mean, I think it does vary significantly. And we're not trying to say, I think we want to be clear here, you know, when Lauren mentioned earlier that the EPA money is about 95% on track, that doesn't mean that that money's been spent already, right? That just means that it's kind of making its way through the pipeline in what seems to be a fairly orderly and timely fashion.
Yeah, and I that makes sense. And I think what even makes more complex is going through different programs and different categories, you know, as we talk about whether it be lead or PFAS. But also, as we've talked about on this podcast, is like state by state, there's wild variation how each state manages its own program from prioritization, but also just like timing of the allocations and such. So, okay, I want to avoid going down a rabbit hole in that area, but I do have a question. And this is one of the, I don't know if concern is the right way to put it, but at the beginning of this, when IIJA was rolled out, there was a lot of talk about disadvantaged communities. And then the question came up, well, how are these disadvantaged communities being defined? We've talked a little bit about this, I think, in the report, or at least sort of provided what updates we have. Any thoughts on that or perspective?
Yeah, I mean, so this is something that's been a really big priority of the Biden administration and, you know, certainly the Biden EPA. There's this kind of Justice 40 initiative that the Biden administration launched at the pretty early days of his presidency, which is really geared towards ensuring that at least 40% of the benefits of, you know, kind of any major federal investments are going to disadvantaged communities, to environmental justice communities, and that kind of thing. So in the context of the water sector, the way that that's kind of operationalized in the IIJA is that by program, there's kind of a certain share of funding. So we'll talk about SRF. I think that's really where we have the most detailed information for the various SRF programs that we talked about, you know, clean water, drinking water, lead, PFAS. A certain share of the total funding has to be offered as either grants or forgivable loans targeted at disadvantaged communities, which is a very different model from the way that the SRF programs typically operate, where the majority of the funding is offered as kind of a standard loan, you know, a below market rate loan. And usually we see larger communities, better resource communities, are the ones who usually get that money, right? So there's this very explicit effort to make sure that disadvantaged communities get that funding. You know, it's 49% of drinking water SRF and the lead service line program funding has to be offered in this way, you know, 25% of the PFAS and emerging contaminants program, et cetera, right? So to your point a minute ago, Reese, it's, you know, it's a key priority for the EPA and for the Biden administration, but states still have a really significant amount of leeway to actually decide how they're going to define disadvantaged communities, right? They kind of have to do it in some way, right? The EPA has even kind of threatened to take SRF funding away from states that don't meet these percentage thresholds, that don't get 49% of their funding to disadvantaged communities, for example. But states are able to decide how they're actually going to define those communities, how they're going to draw that line. And every state is different, right? We went through this earlier in the year to try to just get a sense for like how states are actually doing this. And there's like 17 different indicators that states use some combination of. Many of them are, I think most of them actually use median household income, but they also look at things like, you know, it could be water rates, it could be water system size, it could be property values, it could be, you know, unemployment or poverty rates. And so every state is a little unique in the kind of configuration of variables that they look at when they're deciding who is a disadvantaged community and who isn't. And so to pull back, I know it's kind of wonky stuff, like why does it really matter? You know, I think the intentions are really noble, right? I mean, we know very well that there are, you know, a lot of communities, a lot of people around the country that have suffered from, you know, decades of disinvestment in their water, wastewater, stormwater infrastructure. But it just adds this trade-off there to trying to address that, is it adds this other layer of complexity, of bureaucracy, of kind of friction to getting this money out the door and into the ground.
Yeah, which is widely different from like ARRA back at the last recession. It was like shovel ready, just get it done for good or bad. You know, that was all about speed. This is more about more targeted allocations of funding. So no, I appreciate that. And you're right. It's something we've been talking a bit about, and clients have had a lot of questions as well. So let's change gears a little bit, because I know there's a slide or two and some discussion on, is it Build American, Buy American, Buy American, Build American, BABA, probably a better way to call it, and we're clean with that. So Lauren or Eric, maybe both can add something. What's the status of the any changes? Has that been developed even further from the initial announcements?
Yeah, so I can start off with this. So taking just a quick step back, the IIJA introduced these strict new domestic sourcing requirements for federally funded infrastructure projects, creating significant new administrative burdens for utilities and supply chain partners in the form of the Build American, Buy American, or BABA requirements. So on November 3rd of 2022, the EPA released its BABA implementation procedures for Office of Water Financial Assistance Programs, which provided further clarity to water utilities and suppliers on these exact requirements. So this included new lists on water sector items that fall within each of the three product categories that are subject to the BABA requirements, these being iron and steel products, construction materials, as well as manufactured products. More clarity on who is responsible for maintaining these requirements, that being utilities versus contractors versus the vendors. waivers that have been approved to date, and finally, new waivers that are currently under consideration, such as short-term product waivers that are being considered due to the ongoing supply chain constraints that are continuing in the market.
All right. So, Lauren, that's super helpful. So one question, I just want to jump in here for a second because, you know, I know you have other thoughts, but, and maybe more importantly, is like, what does this mean for the market or the players in the market? Any perspective on that?
Yeah, definitely. So while all of the stakeholders that are involved in this value chain are required to maintain the BABA compliance, so this includes the manufacturers, distributors, suppliers, and utilities, the utilities have been encouraged by the Office of Water to shift most of this responsibility to consultants and contractors. We do expect that the BABA requirements are set to create a competitive advantage for these manufacturers that are sourcing their products and materials domestically, as well as create new burdens for the utilities and vendors that are more reliant on these imported products and components because there are these requirements that are making them be sourced domestically. We do also anticipate that despite the IIJA's emphasis on disadvantaged communities, smaller utilities, which are really unable to afford these high-end consultants and lack internal staffing resources for managing BABA compliance, will face greater burdens relative to these larger, better resource utilities. And just one last point, the EPA's Office of Water will also need to add significant new market research capabilities to verify these compliance requirements as well as evaluate waivers, which could potentially contribute to delays as well as friction for federally funded infrastructure projects going forward.
Yeah, that's great. No, I think that's helpful. I mean, Eric, you know, I also posed it to you as well. Anything to add to what Lauren said or anything else?
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of build on a couple of points there, I think, you know, one of the things that we've been really interested in that it is kind of fleshed out a little bit more in this guidance document is the waivers, right? I mean, there's a couple of different conditions that enable funding agencies as well as, you know, individual kind of projects or utilities or applicants to get waivers for those kind of BABA domestic sourcing requirements. The EPA has applied for a couple kind of program-wide waivers for, you know, for the SRF program, for WIFIA, for a few other things. And if you go through and you read their kind of arguments as to why they should get these waivers, it's really interesting about what they're worried about. Basically, the waivers that they've gotten approved for so far, and this was earlier last year, I think we've even talked about it on this podcast, but as a refresher, basically the idea is if a project had already completed significant engineering and design work prior to May 14th of last year, which is when the BABA requirements actually went into effect. If a project had already completed significant, you know, design and engineering by that point, the EPA didn't want to make those utilities go back to the drawing board and re-engineer, redesign their projects with a new set of exclusively domestic products, right? They thought that was going to take way too much time. It was going to add way too much cost to these projects that were already underway. And the longer term ramifications, they were worried that, you know, utilities might start to fail to meet their public health compliance targets because they're not able to build the infrastructure that they need in a timely manner. And they may actually drive utilities to just back off any federal funding and just find other ways to finance their projects because these requirements were too difficult, right? I mean, that's one of the things that's really important about BABA is that the requirements that have been introduced don't only apply to money associated with IIJA. They're kind of attached to all federal infrastructure funding of all kinds moving forward. So that could be SRF in 10 years time, you know, after IIJA money has gone out. It could be FEMA money, it could be community development block grants. All of this money now has these requirements attached to it. So, you know, that's the concern is that, you know, if the EPA and if the federal government pushes too hard on this, they could just turn utilities off of federal infrastructure funding to begin with. And we've seen that. I mean, Black & Veatch actually releases this really interesting utility survey every year. And the one last year, the strategic directions report from last year, they surveyed a bunch of utilities, and I think it was about almost a quarter of the utilities surveyed said that they didn't have any intention to apply for any of this new federal infrastructure funding, you know, IIJA money or ARPA, because they thought that the requirements were too complex, too burdensome, too difficult to kind of to follow. So there's a real concern there. But I think, you know, that being said, we also don't get the sense that the EPA or the federal government are going to back down from this, right? Those waivers that are in place are time bound, right? As we get to, you know, as we move further and further away from May 14th of last year, more and more projects are going to be starting their design and engineering, you know, with BABA already in place, they have to meet these requirements. And so utilities, you know, vendors, suppliers, distributors, contractors, you know, people really need to figure out, take a serious look at their, you know, kind of sourcing and supply chain arrangements and figure out how they can meet this if, you know, if they're not already, right? I mean, you know, players that are already really based in that are really relying on domestic supply chains actually are going to have a significant competitive advantage here. We could see some kind of shakeups in market share and things like that for certain product segments. Players that are a lot more import reliant, I mean, if they want to get this money, this, you know, once in a lifetime infrastructure funding that we're talking about, they need to figure out a way to kind of meet these requirements. And I think it's going to have a big impact on just how the industry supply chain looks moving forward.
Yeah, I think, but it goes beyond just this funding as well, right? It'll stretch out. I mean, once in a lifetime, yeah, here's some big dollars. It's a big lump sum, but those hurdles are not going to go away. So, you know, it just takes a lot of thinking. And I know a lot of players, you know, I know there are engineering firms with big procurement teams that sort of are mapping this out, trying to figure out, as we know, and we try, there's a lot of kit, a lot of widgets to go into the water and wastewater sector. It's not just, you know, fancy membranes and such. It's a lot more than just that. So this has been super helpful and kind of a nice surprise because it's a question that's come up. I know that whether it's either Eric, you or Lauren, someone came across this in November, December. So, you know, partly because of the holidays, we do take time off. There's been a little bit of delay in getting this out, but I think it's well-deserved for everybody at Bluefield. Sorry to everybody who's waiting on it, but I know it's in the final stages to be released to clients. So if anybody has any questions about that, you know, you can always reach out to Lauren or Eric. I'm certain they will be happy to have a conversation with you.
And on that vein, just to make a plug, we're doing a webcast as well on, I think, February 1st. We're going to be looking at another piece of research that we put out recently, which was our kind of US and Canada CapEx, OpEx forecasts. A lot of what we're talking about here has been, you know, played a big role in kind of how we've thought about that. And we're going to be digging in even deeper on some of those issues for our clients. So if you're a client, take a look, sign up, you know, you have access to it, and we hope to see everybody on there.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I actually talked a little bit about that in the intro before you guys jumped on, that we have an upcoming webcast. But yeah, I mean, it all sort of, it's all going to the same spot one way or another. So I appreciate the plug. Well, speaking of plugs, what else is going on? What else are you guys working on? Why don't we start with you, Lauren? What else after this document, what's next on your plate?
Yeah, so currently working on a report on that explores the Canadian municipal water market a little bit more. We're going to be driving in a bit deeper into the ongoing drivers there. So what's going on when it comes down to what do the housing starts look like? What does the funding look like there? Really just to flush that out a bit, and then moving into our expanding our research on the stormwater market as well. So that's in my pipeline.
Nice. Well, that'll be great. And Eric, what about you?
On the digital side, we've got a big kind of global metering report that's been in the works for a little bit, and we're getting pretty close to that one. Also kind of targeting a few specific deals and partnerships and things like that that have been interesting. Even, I mean, it seems like it's been a pretty active news month so far to start off the year, both at just kind of a national global news level. There's a lot happening, but even within the water industry, we've seen a couple of interesting M&A deals. We've seen some interesting partnerships and stuff announced. So yeah, it feels like things are just kind of a lot of activity all of a sudden, which is always good to see.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's worth calling out. I agree with you. There's some interesting stuff happening on that front. And the other thing is, you know, what we've also been doing, just to shout out to some others on the team, whether it be Isabel and Jaime, and Charlie at Bluefield, they have been digging into sort of the wastewater data, spending a lot more time really doing a deeper dive evaluation of the size of the systems. Like, really, what is the size of that market? For those not in the know, the water, drinking water side of the municipal equation is the data from EPA and states has always been a little bit cleaner and easier to deal with in figuring out number of connections or population and flow and such. Whereas on the wastewater side, it's a bit more opaque. But yeah, we see big opportunities there. So we've been spending a lot of time one in working with a client on that data, but also, you know, working towards just making our data set even better with respect to wastewater. As well as, I might add one last thing, because I'm looking at Eric on video as we record this, and that is on the assets. We have a treasure trove of, I can't tell you how many assets, from tanks to pump stations to wells, et cetera, that we're working on and cleaning up to visualize on our Data Navigator platform, which is showcases, or it's a dashboard that allows clients and users to sort of filter, sort through, and interactively play with the data, which, last point, back to this IIJA report, that data will also be in our Data Navigator platform for clients, so they can always go figure out exactly where those dollars are going beyond just the report we're putting out with it. It's a lot to unpack at the beginning of 2023, but better to do it now than at the end of 2022 when everybody's going on holiday. So, Lauren, Eric, thanks a million for jumping on. Super helpful, super informative. Great work, and appreciate the time and effort to sit down with me.
Thanks, Reese.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Lauren.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep. You guys take care.
Take it easy.
All right, there you have it. That was super interesting conversation with Eric and Lauren, and super helpful. I mean, there were a couple of things that they alluded to that we didn't touch on specifically, and that was, you know, there's some recent news coming out that's interesting that we've been tracking, and that's obviously Badger acquired Syrinix. Badger, the metering company out of Wisconsin, thought was interesting. And then also Xylem has announced a partnership with the Spanish company Idrica, which is really interesting to see what happens there. So those are both on the digital side, something we've been tracking. There's just a lot of other news that's happening, you know, now that people are done with the holidays, into a new year, they're ready to kick it off, and there's some M&A happening. So that's a positive and good sign. So before we sign off, just wanted to bring this up again. Truth be told, there have been tons of clients coming to our office, so don't be a stranger. If you're in Boston, let us know. We can set up a meeting at our new location. We also have a new location in Barcelona, a new office there. We've moved, and so if you're in Barcelona, which is always a nice place to be this time of year, at least if you're coming from New England, pay us a visit over there. As I mentioned from the outset, please subscribe to the Future Water podcast. Give us a review, but also Waterline. That's the easy way to find out what we're up to. Any questions, comments, or topic ideas you'd like us to discuss, waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. That's the email. Everybody's watching it, so send us a note and say hi. Tell us what you want to hear us talk about. And lastly, tell a friend about the Future Water podcast. That's a good way to spread the wealth and share the information. So this podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and take care.